As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Kelly, and I'm your host for The View from the Lane, the Athletic's Tottenham Hotspur podcast. Thank you for listening to us. On the show today with me are The Athletic's Jack Pitt-Brook and Charlie Eccleshare. I hope we can make this one a little bit less gloomy than the last one, though with the Chelsea fixture coming up on the horizon, I'm not entirely sure that we can. Charlie, before we discuss that oncoming train that is Chelsea this weekend, James Moore, who isn't with us today, has said that he's been hearing chants being sung around the club's managing director of football, Fabio Paratici. I haven't heard these. Well, what's he talking about?
So this was something I tweeted on Saturday. I was at Selhurst Park when the Spurs coach arrived and the players walked out, and then Don Fabio Paratici walked out. And I tweeted they sung his name, and it caused a bit of a stir, people sort of speculating as to what that chant might be. Might be a bit of a letdown. It wasn't any kind of clever wordplay on Paratici. It was just a kind of dull thudding. Fabio, Fabio, Fabio.
Oh, God.
And he gave a wink to the fans as he walked in, kind of looking very suave as he did so. But yeah, nothing more than that, I'm afraid.
The landscape of football changes all the time, but I didn't imagine that I would live long enough that people would not only know the owners, the names of the owners of clubs, but also the so-called directors of football.
Managing director, comma, football is his title.
Oh, Corey, sorry, I forgot he had a phony baloney title. And it's amazing that we now know the names of directors of football. On the European football show that I do on the radio, no conversation is complete unless you know the name of the chief scout of Sporting Lisbon. I mean, gone the days when if you knew two foreign players' names, that was acceptable.
I think that's one. We were talking about this on the Football Clichés podcast in relation to the Fabio chant. And I think that has been one of the biggest shifts is in your kind of average fan, the level of knowledge that they have about transfers and how they work and all that sort of thing is so different to what it was. And I was talking to an old colleague of mine who covers Arsenal, and he was remembering similarly to this Paratici thing a couple of years ago when Raul Sanyehi was briefly flavour of the month with Arsenal fans. And he said he remembers similarly him getting off the coach and being mobbed by the Arsenal fans before a game against Liverpool. And was thinking, the world's gone mad. Like, how is it that this guy, this sort of transfer guru, who then left because it turned out he wasn't so good, is kind of being heralded like one of the star players?
Let's talk about your article in the Athletic this week about Dele Alli, if I may, Charlie. Mm. I mean, he's desperately struggling. That sentence that I've got in front of me says he's desperately struggling to create chances and get into goal scoring positions. It could just read he's desperately struggling. So what's behind, in your opinion, and it's okay if you quote from your article, this decline, which I hope isn't terminal, in this lad's career? He's in his mid-20s. He can be whatever he wants, really.
No, it is really, it's a really interesting one. We've spoken about it many times. And I should say as well, your description of Dele as a running job's worth in Monday's pod was part of the inspiration for this piece. I mean,
but it's true,
yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, it's just a strange one because basically he was saying in the piece that he's been repurposed as this sort of midfield hatchet man who runs around, puts in fouls, and you know, he's got an amazing engine. He's very, very fit, so he can do that role. But he's also proved himself to be an elite goal scorer and creator of goals. I mean, I'd forgotten, we know about his goal scoring was sensational, mm-hmm. but in his first three Premier League seasons, he got 9 assists, and 8 assists, and 10 assists. I mean, those are staggeringly good numbers. This season, he hasn't created a chance yet at all. His total XG that I quote in the piece is something like 0.18. That excludes the 0.16, actually. That excludes Ooh. The penalty, obviously. And it's one of those, how much of this is, you know, how much is he playing that repurposed role because he's not deemed to have the same goal and goal threat and creativity that he once did? Or is he not having that goal threat and creativity because he's being asked to do this this role that you feel there are other people in the squad who could do? Whereas clearly there aren't really people in the squad other than Kane and Son who score. I mean, I looked at this, and since the start of last season, own goal with 3 is the top scorer in the Premier League for Spurs of players outside of Kane and Son. Obviously, Bale has more, but he's gone. So that does kind of tell you, and this is something I know we've spoken about before, how big an issue that lack of a third goal scorer is. And it feels like in Delhi, they have someone who could potentially do that. You know, he's proven himself able to do that again and again and again. But the goals are just, you know, gone from his game.
Jack, where do you think the problem lies? I mean, I'll give you some of the Athletic's readers have had plenty to say about this. I mean, Dele isn't defending instead of attacking because he's forgotten how to attack, says Ruben A. He's defending because we don't have the ball. Why haven't we got the ball? Dom B, Kane doesn't want to be anywhere near the box right now, a bit like Rooney in his later years at United. So is he now playing the same spaces you'd expect to see Dele? Very quickly, my own Tuppenny Hackney worth is that Dele has always been a fantastic player, or was a fantastic player in the last third. And even when we were doing proper pressing at Tottenham, he and Christian Eriksen led the band. And he often made goals by getting his toe in. But equally often, he committed fouls. That's fine. It fitted, let's be honest about it, it fitted Pochettino's plan to do tactical fouling. He did it at Southampton. He did it at Spurs. They rotated the fouling to stop teams on the break. The problem with Dele as this enforcer is that he does these half tackles and he's giving away free kicks on the edge of the box. He gave away four
fouls against Palace.
Absolutely, and all in difficult positions. Jack, you know, you're perhaps looking at it from further away than Charlie. Maybe you have a better view of the trees and the forest. Dele Alli?
I think the problem is that he is actually very well suited to the kind of midfield that Nuno seems to want. Nuno wants a midfield based on industry and running and pressing, rather, and he doesn't seem to want midfield based on creating chances in the middle of the pitch. He doesn't want midfielders who get in the box. So I think Dele has been really admirable in his adaptation to the demands of Nuno's approach. I just think that approach is not very interesting, or at least not very interesting to watch. I don't think the problem is, as described in one of the comments, that Spurs don't have the ball enough. I just think Dele is honestly and quite diligently doing what his manager tells him to do, but it has only exacerbated the kind of lack of goals that have really marked the last sort of 3 years of his career.
It's interesting because, sorry, Joe M says, and I'll come back to your thoughts, Dele has never been much of a creator. He gets on the end of things, but with no creativity in the team, if we're going to do this podcast properly, I better learn to pronounce the word creativity correctly. It comes up a lot. There's nothing to get on the end of. Eriksen made him in many ways. Let me ask you a crueler question. And I'll quote from somebody from Tottenham's recent past who I also adore as a player. And that's Jermaine Defoe. The game changed. We went from 2 up front to 1 up front. The 1 up front had to be somebody with physical presence. And the game disappeared over the horizon from Jermaine Defoe. I get it. He's still winning titles at 74 years of age in Scotland. But in the Premier League, the game changes. Has the game changed in a way, Jack, that it has no use for the Dele Allis of this world anymore?
No, I don't think that's true, because I think someone like Dele Alli could be very effective for another team that played a pressing style. I can actually see him, you know, this is not me trying to sell Dele Alli,
no,
as someone I've been accused of doing, but I can see him being effective, for example, at Liverpool, you know, because Liverpool have a very high energy pressing system. And frankly, the Liverpool approach isn't that different from the Nuno approach at the moment, which is we're going to have a very kind of jobs worth midfield, mm-hmm. as you put it, and all our creativity is going to come, for example, from the fullbacks. So I don't think Dele Alli is implausible as a modern footballer nowadays. I just think he could only work in a very specific system. But what I do think, the one change that I do think has caused a problem for Dele is the simple fact that Tottenham play much further down. They don't play as high up the pitch as they did 4 years ago. You know, under Pochettino, he got to play for a team who would defend on the halfway. You know, there were kind of elements of the sort of Guardiola style to how Spurs played 4 years ago. You know, they would defend on the halfway line. They'd almost always have the ball. They would, you know, push the fullbacks high. They'd play with width. They'd win the ball back high up the pitch. And so the whole team, you know, they would always be closer to the opposition goal than they are now. And obviously, that started to retreat at the end of Pochettino. And then under Mourinho, they retreated much further. And they still just don't play on the front foot like they used to. And that means if you're someone like Dele Alli, whose whole game is about, you know, sniffing out a bounce of the ball here or just kind of sensing where the ball's going to break and can I get in that space and get a header off or whatever, you're not getting there so many opportunities because you used to be floating around sort of 15 yards in the opposition goal and now you're on the halfway line.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I've been trying to think, like, what sort of precedent is there for kind of, because we've seen with Dele, he scored lots of goals. Now he hasn't been for a while. Can you then get that back? Can you rediscover that? And also thinking about which players he plays like now. And I was thinking someone like Jesse Lingard, who obviously in the World Cup 2018, wasn't it, that him and Dele were kind of playing as those three eights in what was essentially a 3-5-2. And Lingard obviously last season went on loan at West Ham, scored a bunch of goals. He's scoring again this season for Manchester United. And I wonder if that's the kind of player that Dele will become, more of a number eight who makes runs from deep rather than someone who plays further forward like he used to, just because it is harder to play as a kind of off the striker type player. As you say, Danny, that does feel almost like an anachronism already.
These things go in cycle, but I don't think he can wait for the good of his career for second strikers to come back into fashion. Not when people like Son and Mo Salah, etc., are continuing to prove that you can get 20 goals a season from the wide positions.
Well, that is slightly the problem. Sorry to interject. Mm. I mean, like we talked
never
about
apologise. As long as you're going
to
say something new or funny, by all means, jump in. If it's just going to be the same old nonsense, back off, fella.
I should probably back off then.
No, don't say your piece.
That is something we've talked about before, though, is that Dele is quite unusual in that he's, for a goal scoring attacker, he's not either a striker or a wide forward. Because almost all of these guys who do score goals from those sort of positions can play as wide forwards, which is how every team plays, like you say, Salah, Son. And you do wonder if he needs to adapt to be able to play that role. And I don't know if any thought's been given to that as to whether playing as, you know, in an inside right or inside left sort of position would be better for him vis-a-vis goal scoring.
Let me ask you, put your mind towards the end of this season. Is Dele Alli going to be a permanent member of Spurs' first team? Can he recover his standing as a footballer, if not his England place and the kind of returns that we were getting from him 3 and 4 years ago?
I think he will still be in the team just because I think he ticks the boxes of what Nuno wants from midfielder. As much as some of us might rather it was Lo Celso or Ndombele trying to create chances, I think that given what Nuno wants, I think that Dele will stay in there. I don't think there are many better options for that kind of player.
Yeah, you can't imagine there are going to be many games where Nuno thinks, do I want someone in midfield who has the legs to harass and harry opponents and get up and down the pitch? There probably aren't going to be many where he doesn't want that. And so you would think he will. I mean, the problem is he might be slotted in here, there and everywhere according to what's needed. I mean, I said in the piece, and Jack's alluded to it as well, He's been. It's almost like, you know, he's sacrificing himself for the greater good of the team, and that's to be applauded.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't surprise me if it carries on this current trajectory. He gets a ton of minutes, covers a lot of ground, but doesn't score many goals or provide many assists.
Okay, well, all I'll say is, you know, people always talk about that overhead sort of juggle and that volley against Crystal Palace, I think it was, and saying, where's that player gone? He's always going to have a place in my heart, actually, for that moment in the Amsterdam Arena, because everyone remembers Llorente taking the ball out of the sky, but it's Dele Alli who plays the most important and exquisite four-foot pass in Spurs' history into the path of Lucas Moura. Yeah. It could only go one place. Their defenders were coming in, and he put it on the exact spot on the earth where Moura had to have it to have the first touch to get it past the goalkeeper. I'll always, and that's what caused me to burst into tears, of course, and the tears ran down my big old space opera head.
I spoke to him about that,
right,
for the piece we did, Jack and I did last May on the anniversary of the Moura hat-trick game. And because, yeah, we... like you, we talked a lot about that moment. So did ask him about it and ask him sort of what he thought about it. I said, what's your memory of that? He said, not much. Everything I do is completely instinctive in football. I can just remember praying he would finish it. And sure enough, he did.
There are lovely touches and there are lovely, exquisite touches. That was a belter.
It was. But I think that does, that completely instinctive. I mean, it looked that way, didn't it? And that was kind of Dele at his best, playing off the cuff, on instinct, doing things that... I mean, so few other players would conceive of that flick and let alone be able to actually pull it off.
Not a lot of off the cuff at Tottenham now.
We don't have any cuffs, and you're right to say if you're right to say that if they fall further and further back, soon they'll be trying to change the rules. So like ice hockey, you can go behind the goal as well. And that would seem to suit the current batch of Spurs managers. Listen, you thought that was bleak? Talking about a player who was great and is no longer great. Wait till you hear the next section when we preview the game against Chelsea.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, everybody. You're listening to The View from the Lane, and we're really, really glad that those of you who download the podcast, listen to any or all of them, and tell your friends. If you're enjoying them, tell your friends. I'm Danny Kelly. Alongside me, of course, are Charlie Eccleshare and Jack Pitbrook. I'll put it off for as long as I can. We have to face up to the fact that following what by most people's measurement was the worst Spurs performance for a couple of years, that whacking they got at Selhurst Park, the gods of football, ever pixie-ish, have then thrown up Spurs' next fixture to be against one of the best two cut teams in the country. You could argue Chelsea are the best. They got home advantage. I always hang on to that straw very, very strongly. Let me ask you first of all a question about the squad for this game. And this is, we should make the point, we're recording this before we see who Nuno puts out for the game in Rennes. Should the South American players, released from the radiators from which they've been chained in Croatia, but touching down at Heathrow or in some private jet, actually probably at Luton, should they go into the squad? Should they indeed go into the team, Jack?
Yeah, I am expecting the Dubrovnik three to be involved on Sunday in some capacity. I think they should start, to be honest. You know, they're not, frankly, players start Sunday afternoon games having arrived back from Latin America on the Saturday. These guys have just taken, it won't literally be an EasyJet flight from Dubrovnik, but, you know, anyone who's been on holiday to that part of the world, no, it's only, I don't know, 2.5 hours or whatever. Yeah. So there shouldn't be an issue with jet lag or anything like that. And they've spent the last week, I imagine, probably having a nice, not just having a nice time on the beach, they've done some football as well, but they should be relaxed, refreshed, and also motivated to kind of pay Spurs back a bit. I think I'm kind of mixed feelings about this. I mean, initially being very sympathetic to the players, having watched how awful Spurs were against Palace, I thought they probably should have been there, shouldn't they?
It did exactly the same thing went on in my head. Initially, I was saying, look at those lovely patriots. And now I think, look at those traitors to the club. Never mind. You think they'll play, Charlie?
Yeah, I do. I mean, is your question, do you think they shouldn't play as a sort of punitive measure?
No, it's a question of
fitness.
More likely, well, Nuno in particular is one of these who forever going on about practicing tactics on the ground and all the rest of it. They haven't been, I mean, let's be honest. Look, the background to this, of course, is that footballers' training has changed completely during COVID. Their training and travel has all been messed about with. And so I think the days when they had to have 4 days clear to do the training and the warm down, and then a day in front of a blackboard to do the tactical thing, that may have been changed a lot in the last 18 months. And I wonder whether that's the excuse you'd use to get them back in the team.
Yeah, that's a good point, because speaking to former colleagues of his at Wolves for a big piece on him I did, they said that he wouldn't play a player unless they'd trained pretty much during the week. And actually what he'd often do, even players who weren't fully fit, he'd still involve them in training. He'd just ask his, you know, the experts on the medical side of things to say, well, what can they do to be involved that won't exacerbate any injuries? That's how important it was to him to have everyone there. So it will be quite interesting and revealing if he does play them, you know, given that they won't have been able to be involved in any meaningful sense, and how kind of, you know, confident that they can get what they needed to whilst they were away. But I definitely think, I mean, look, certainly someone like Romero, you would think it would seem strange to spend that much money on him. He's clearly someone I think will make a huge difference and then not play him. So I'd expect him to come back in. Sanchez and Lo Celso, I mean, who knows? But Lo Celso, they have missed that kind of player. I think, you know, they could really do with him in midfield.
Well, I mean, let's say for the sake of argument that they are all back in good odour. You say Romero starts. Who would start next to him if they play a back four? And I have a reason for saying that so portentously. Do we know if Dyer's going to be fit?
He should be. I mean, it's not been confirmed, but sounds reasonably positive on that one. So he could well be available, yeah.
What about, I mean, Sanchez and Romero? Given that they spent the last 10 days together, they're probably Spurs, assuming that Dyer's not 100% fit, Sanchez and Romero must be Spurs' two best available centre-backs. You might as well have both of them instead of one of them. Also, Romero only, as far as I'm aware, Romero doesn't speak any English, so you might be better, it might be safer having Romero alongside Sanchez rather than Romero alongside Rode. And that said, Dyer famously does speak very good Spanish. And that's one of the reasons why Dyer's a kind of dressing room glue. So not that this matters too much, but given that I've started this bit, if linguistics are to be the defining factor, then you would have to partner Romero with Dyer or Sanchez, but maybe not Roden or Davis.
Roden and Davis, and they could speak in Welsh to one another. And outfox Lukaku, who'd just be so baffled.
No idea, yeah.
I'm going to throw this into it. We've got to work out how Spurs are going to beat Chelsea. What about matching up to them? Having got injured and suspended centre-halves and centre-halves who spent the last 3 weeks in South America in Dubrovnik, what about playing three at the back, Jack, and going and matching Chelsea exactly?
Do Spurs have three fit, settled, stable centre-backs? I'm not sure they do.
Well, the two South Americans and Dyer?
Yeah, maybe. I just don't see why. I don't know. To me, that feels like too much of a risk. You're playing too many players over whom there are question marks and maybe not enough other players. But then, of course, it is a system that worked well for Nuno at Wolves.
We know what the solution is there, Jack. And it's Ben Davis.
Ben Davis, the left centre-back, yeah.
That is the panacea.
Never really worked for Tottenham. It's one of those things that people always go on about because it worked well at Euro 2016, which was 5 years ago. It was quite a long time ago. It was literally before the Brexit referendum that Ben Davis was very good at left centre-back.
Was after the Brexit referendum because it happened... The Brexit referendum was 2 days before the Northern Ireland game. So technically it has worked post-Brexit, in a post-Brexit world.
Yeah, I should have remembered that. I was there.
I do think 3-5-2, though, I mean, we've talked about this before, and in our mine and Jack's controversial ideal Spurs 11s, I push for a three at the back.
Yeah.
And we got absolutely screamed at for those by Spurs fans. So to which Spurs fans say, I hold my hand up, it was really bad. You were right. Reguilon is better than Ben Davis.
That was a huge call from you, Jack. I mean, I had Davis in the team, but I did also have Reguilon. But the timing of it wasn't great because we both did it 2 days before the Palace game where Davis gave away the penalty and didn't have his best day.
If my brilliant plan to play three at the back is not going to work against Chelsea, what is, Charlie?
I mean, I'm not ruling it out. I think there's a lot of merits to it.
Thank you.
I mean, the thing is, the blueprint has got to be the City game, hasn't it? On the opening weekend, because that was pretty much perfect. They and that's not rewriting history.
No.
I mean, that's not just the result. It wasn't one where they got absolutely battered and pinched it. They got battered for the first 10 minutes, granted. But after that, they had a genuine threat. City didn't really create a lot. It was pretty much the dream counter-attacking performance against a superior opposition. And Chelsea, you know, I think Spurs fans would admit, are that. You know, they're the European champions. They've strengthened with Lukaku. They're a formidable outfit. But that was Tottenham's best performance of the season. And I do wonder if, like Wolves, who, if we remember, specialised at beating big six clubs in inverted commas, including often away from home, including Spurs 2 years running. I do wonder if, and James mentioned this on Monday's pod, whether it will... It could, and again, clutching at straws, I know, could suit them playing a team who'll come at them. So I imagine he'll try and set up very, very similarly to how he did in that game, which was the Dele, Skip, Højbjerg midfield axis, and then Son assuming he's back. On that day, it was Bergvall and Moura. Obviously, now you've got Kane in, and then one of Bergvall and Moura.
Would you drop Kane so that you could get recreate that balance against City?
No.
I suppose two best players in that game were Bergwijn and Lucas Moura.
Yeah,
and Bergwijn was incredible on the break, and City couldn't really live with Bergwijn at all. And like, I actually think Chelsea are probably better now against the counter-attack than City are, but it probably is the best way to get at Chelsea. You'd imagine would be Bergwijn breaking down the middle like he did against City. So I hope for that reason alone that Bergwijn plays on Sunday.
I think he will, but I think it'll be Moura who makes way, with Son probably playing more in a role.
You're confident Son will be fit, yeah?
I wouldn't say. I think he will. I think from what I'm hearing, I think he will play, but who knows? I mean, it's 3 days away.
Because that's the Wolves team, the transitions they did to beat teams, as you're describing, who were pressing them really hard and forcing them back, was the long passing of Ruben Neves. And the pace of Adama Traore. They allowed them to get from one end to the pitch to the other in two touches of the ball. It won't work unless some combination of Moura, Bergwijn and Son have got to have brilliant game on the break. Otherwise, we'll keep running up against Jorginho and his little gang in the middle of the pitch there.
That Wolves comparison is something that slightly frustrates me about Nuno Spurs, is that Wolves did have, you know, they weren't great to watch. They did have a lot of quality in midfield in Neves and Moutinho. You know, Neves is a good player and Moutinho's been a great player for about 25 years now. And yet at Tottenham, he has some quite technically good midfielders, but he doesn't really seem interested in using them.
Well, they don't seem to want to pass the ball forward more than 10 yards,
yeah.
Which is, of course, one of the reasons why Kane keeps turning up as a sort of number 10, doesn't he? Leaving a sort of massive vacuum, like one of those things they photograph with a newly refurbished Hubble Space Telescope, because there's nobody the other side of him in the team. But actually, that's something that Son, Bergwijn, Moura, whatever combination they play, must learn to do. If Kane is going to continue, and he's a very good link player, if he's going to continue to do that, somebody's got to get not just next to him to receive the ball, but beyond him to receive the final ball. And at the moment, it is the caution of Nuno that I think is perhaps, whether or not it's really what they think he wants, somehow the players look a bit constricted to me.
But that aspect of the game has worked less well under Nuno. I mean, it's been incredibly early days, but less well under Nuno than it did under Mourinho. Mm. You know, whatever you might think about Mourinho, Spurs had a really good plan for scoring goals under Mourinho, which is that Son would run beyond Kane and Kane would play the pass through. And this year, Spurs haven't even managed to do that yet. And of course, you know, Kane's had his own problems and Son's just got injured, so they haven't had that many opportunities. But if Spurs lose that link up, then they're really going to struggle to score goals this season.
Well, that is the problem with not having a third goal scorer. I mean, there are many issues with not having a third goal scorer, but it gets laid bare when one of those two is out. It's, you know, especially we saw Son, they were without Son on the weekend. Who's, you know, and then Kane, it's, you know, he's less effective. He's slightly less sure of whether he wants to be playing as a 10 or as a 9, and it all falls apart. Like, it feels like it's very shaky foundations. If those two stay fit, they'll have a reasonable season, whatever happens. But if one of them is out for any length of time, then you would worry for this team.
I have to say, I hope people have downloaded this podcast correctly and on a good internet connection, so that it's not flickering and missing individual words, because you might, if you were listening to this conversation for the last 5 minutes, think that we were advocating three at the back, including Eric Dier or Ben Davis, and dropping Kane for this game. So I hope you've heard every single word, because otherwise it's going to sound very strange indeed. So that's the plan, is it? We play that Spurs play deep with their triple deep block in midfield, and the creativity issue is solved by somebody very fast running with the ball, yeah?
That's part of the problem with the Liverpool comparison, is that, you know, obviously Liverpool don't need to create chances through midfield because they've got Robertson and Alexander-Arnold, who are, you know, two of the best fullbacks in the Premier League, and Alexander-Arnold is like a unique player, the like of which we've not really seen before. Whereas it's for Tottenham, you know, Reguilon is good at some things, but it's pretty patchy, and Emerson Royale, the guy's only just showed up, so it's far too early to judge him. But if Spurs are going to create chances only through the fullbacks this season, then the fullbacks are going to have to start playing really, really well, basically, and that's a lot of pressure.
Like you say, we don't know what Emerson's going to do. Sergio Reguilon, I like him because he's all running and appears to enjoy playing the football. His final ball, I suppose patchy would be a very apt word. Unpredictable.
I think you're a bit harsh on Reguilon. I was listening on Monday, your description of him in the Palace game. I thought he was actually quite good, and I thought he defended a lot better than he often has. I thought there was that one in the first half where Gallagher thinks he has a tap in from a few yards out, and Reguilon covers all the way from his own station on the left into more of that right-sided central channel and makes a really good block. And there was that one under the bar as well that he got rid of. I think he started the season quite strongly, but I know he divides opinion, shall we say.
No, I say I really like him. I just want his passing, and I'm not, but hang on, beep, this is me backing out my previous opinion under pressure from your current one. Beep. No, I think I really like him, and I think he can be a very, very good Premier League player. His passing down the line is okay. His crossing has yet to been up to the standard. But, of course, crosses are often judged by whether or not somebody gets on the end of them. But this season so far, we've only had one person in the penalty box. So the crosses are made to look a little bit worse than they are, perhaps.
To that point, I screenshotted in the Delhi piece. There was an instance late on the game. Spurs are 2-0 down. Reguilon gets the ball out wide on the left, and Delhi, rather than kind of running into the box as you'd expect him to, drops short for a sort of its square pass. And so Reguilon puts a cross in. Kane is belatedly getting into the box, and it's clear, you know, he's got like one, maybe two targets and about five defenders. So I think, as you said, it's a combination of the two. I mean, there was that one against West Ham in the game that obviously now gets remembered for Spurs conceding three goals in the last 10 minutes. But in the first half, Reguilon puts in a beauty of a cross for, I think it's Harry Kane. So he has that ability, but you just want to see it a bit more often.
Ah, those happy days when West Ham are useless enough that Lanzini could still get in the team. No, we're near it at the moment, is he? Listen, thank you very much indeed for the at least attempting to work out how Spurs might take on Chelsea, because that's the beauty of football, isn't it? Even after that rotten performance at Palace, they've got to play the next game. You can't just lie down in a darkened room for a month trying to sort things out. Which, actually, one of the things I wasn't happy with this week is, I know maybe it's best not to say anything to the press, but I'm sure you don't agree with that, but given what you try to do for a living. Nuno's interviews
cheers,
during the week, where what is the solution, not to the defensive problems, but to the creative problems, is to, quote, do more hard work on the training ground. I hate that construction, because that's what you should be doing anyway, obviously, and it's got to work. And I felt, you know, there's a Spurs connection today that kind of broke my heart. Chris Hughton, wonderful footballer, a bit before your lot's time, but a wonderful footballer and a lovely man. I'm a decent coach too. After the latest calamity with Nottingham Forest, was saying, we've got to get out on that training field. We've got to work harder. That is literally the signal for the board to sack you, because you ought to be... That's the basics, isn't it?
Yeah, but no manager will say, I'm going to go away and think whether my methods actually work. Like, I'm going to go away and think, are my ideas up to date? Because maybe they're not. I think managers have to create... And I don't mean to single Nuno or Hughton or anyone else out for this, but managers always create a real kind of cult of personality around themselves, in which they assume that they have all the answers and that the only problem is the interpretation. It's the execution rather than their intentions and theories themselves. So I think that's why managers will all, you know, if you say we've got to work harder on the training ground, you can kind of effectively blame the players without blaming the players.
And that's because most managers, 95% of them, misunderstand the nature of what they're doing. They think it's science, and the best managers know that it's alchemy.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, into the home straight now, into Added On Time, if you like, in The View from the Lane with Charlie Eccleshare, Jack Pitbrook and myself, Danny Kelly. As I say, we're doing this in the hours before Spurs take to the field against Rennes, and you'll be listening to it largely after the result is known.
We talked quite a lot at the end of the season about, is this a competition Spurs want to be in? Now we're here, and this game falls sandwiched in between a very disappointing loss and Chelsea. What's your view? Are you thinking, great, it's European football, it's a bit of fun, we get to watch a game tonight? Or are you thinking, I'd rather they just had a week off to prepare for the Chelsea game?
For me, the I'd rather they just had a week off view is too modern for me. If you're in these tournaments, you try and win them. You can't have it both ways. You can't say...
But isn't there a tension of modernity there? Because this is also a nonsense modern competition that you never would have had 20 years ago.
There's a kind of having it both ways, isn't there? Spurs have to win a trophy. They try to win trophies, then you get told they're the wrong trophies. So what it is people setting up a narrative of failure because it's easier to write about, it's easier to broadcast about, it's easier to talk about at work. They tried to do this and they failed. I think that this is a perfect opportunity to go deep into a European tournament. And I'm telling you now, Spurs won the Cup Winners' Cup back in the early 60s.
But that was a proper competition.
But the UEFA Cup wasn't a proper competition when it started out. And people don't look at it like that historically now. They say that's the first English club to win a European trophy and all the rest of it. I think, of course, it's ludicrous that that Spurs, in their own minds, are parading. It's like they're wearing some of those costumes that people wore to the Met Ball to the local pub, because it's true, because they are Tottenham Hotspur and some of these clubs are as yet unheard of. But you're in the tournament, try and win it. Now, that doesn't mean you have to play all the first team this week because you're in the group stages. It's when you get into the knockout stages that I don't want to see taking a chance, because let's be honest, let's go back to Colchester in the League Cup, or whatever it's parading as these days, the Carabao Cup. Spurs putting out their second team so far has been disastrous in recent times. What about you? You're a neutral. You want Spurs to try and win this trophy?
My impression of this is that doing well in the Conference League matters more to the club than it does to Nuno. I think Nuno might rather focus on the Premier League form over the course of the season. But, there are obvious benefits to the club of them being in Europe through the course of the year. And it might well be that we'll get to the second half of the season and it'll suddenly get really engaging. I mean, I do think that these things do attract prestige over time. Like, I'm sure in 1956, people would have said that the Eurovision Song Contest was very silly, but now it's obviously a hugely prestigious award, Danny, as I'm sure you agree.
For all aspiring musicians. But I should say as well, Danny, I'm not saying now they're in the competition, should they sack it off? It's more, would you be better just... Because but you touched on something. The reality is, if you're in a competition, the frustrating thing is, a big story and song and dance would be made of Spurs crashing out of the Europa Conference League. So, yeah, once you're in it, you have to make something of it. It's more, would you rather just be spared being in it and therefore you don't have to have any of that nonsense and you can just focus on the league, which ultimately is where Nuno's going to be judged by. It is the important thing. I don't know how, and I'm not saying, I'm putting forward the argument. Yeah. I'm not saying it's worthless, but I wonder as well, hypothetically, if Spurs were to win this competition at the end of the season, what that does for, the trophy drought in inverted commas and kind of how the club
but
feels about
itself. Spurs have quite a big squad at the moment, don't they? They probably have a bigger squad than they should. Nuno would normally have. So I think my guess is it's less costly to Tottenham to, plonk a few eggs in this Europa Conference League basket than it would be if they had a squad of 16, 17 players, given simply that there's a handful of guys who they tried and failed to get rid of over the summer who might as well play some football. And given that the whole squad, I think, need to kind of get up to speed with what we're calling Nuno ball, I think it does sort of make... I can kind of see the benefits of being in it, even if it does feel a bit ridiculous at this point to be slogging around. I mean, frankly, Rennes and Vitesse Arnhem are the least of their worries, but by the second half of the season, it might get a bit tiring.
I think that's true. The other benefit is you can play some young players potentially and maybe Scarlett gets some experience. I guess on a micro level where it's challenging is that if they weren't in this competition, from Monday, it's right, Chelsea. Everything is about that Chelsea game. And Nuno prides himself as a coach and repetition. Like you said, how do you improve creativity? On the training pitch. You know, he would back himself with that week, whereas Chelsea don't get that week. Whereas no matter how seriously you're taking Ren, and, you know, but you have to take it seriously, and all your coaches are working on opposition scouting, et cetera, et cetera. That leaves you with not a huge amount of time to face the European champions. You're then at a slight disadvantage because they've had, when did they play? Tuesday night? So they've got 2 days extra to prepare for. That's quite a big swing, potentially. And, you know, maybe it won't make a difference, but it's a challenge.
Thank you very much indeed. And I must tell you this, of course, Charlie's article on Delhi is very much there on The Athletic. And if you're not already a subscriber, you can read it. And Jack's piece following the Ren game by going to theathletic.com/SpursPod. And right now you can sign up with a 33% discount on a full subscription. We'll be back on Monday when Spurs will have beaten Chelsea. Thank you for listening.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.